Okay. This now is a little unfair here. This is the effect of estrogen dominance. This is when people have estrogen that they're still making, or some doctor's giving it to them, and they are deficient in progesterone. They have a condition I call estrogen dominance. They have more estrogen than they need for the amount of progesterone. Doesn't matter what the total number is. It matters what the ratio is. Look what it does. Water retention, edema, high blood pressure, breast swelling, fibrocystic breast, PMS, mood swings, depression, decreased libido, heavy or regular periods, uterine fibroids, craving for sweets, weight gain, heavy hips and thighs, migraine, pseudo-hypothyroidism. Estrogen impedes the action of your thyroid hormone. Progesterone helps the action of your thyroid hormone. So the typical woman who is estrogen dominant will appear to be hypothyroid. She will have thinning hair. She will have less energy. She does not wake up refreshed. She tells the doctor she feels cold. And the temperature, the morning temperature is down a little bit. And he will say, this is classical hypothyroidism. Okay? And then he will do the test, the T3 and the T4. Has anyone gone through this? Yeah. He does the T3 and T4, and he finds them to be in the normal range. But then he says, but I'm God, and I know better. And he will give you a thyroid anyway. And then what happens? Your own thyroid cuts down by the amount he gave. So then he finds that you need more. And after a year or two, you're taking a considerable amount of thyroid, and you never needed it in the first place. If he'd restored the progesterone, then the thyroid hormone would have worked all right, and you would have been fine. The temperature is the clue. When the body makes the progesterone at ovulation time, your temperature goes up. For that reason, we say progesterone is thermogenic, raises the temperature. Every woman knows this. The Roman Catholic Church knows this. The Pope knows this. Your doctor does not know this. And we don't know why. Because the Church teaches you, if you want to find out when you ovulate and when you're fertile, take your temperature. And they even make special little thermometers. So it shows it in tenths of a degree. And you go up 7/10 of a degree, it means, whoa, you're making progesterone. But say you're not making the progesterone, then your temperature stays down. And the doctor says he knows that's hypothyroidism. You have to be very careful. People who do the test and then say they know better than the test. Granted, tests can be wrong. But I would estimate that 90% of the women on thyroid today in the United States had no trouble with they never had hypothyroidism. They had low progesterone. So all this is well known. None of it is my doing. These are all found in descriptions of estrogen side effects. In fact, there are many more. But I just selected out ones that everybody knows about, and uterine fibroids and so on. Well, I'll tell you about the zinc and the copper business, copper retention. Estrogen raises a protein in your serum called ceruloplasm. Ceruloplasm is what binds to copper. So you end up with more copper in your bloodstream, and that inhibits zinc absorption. So you have elevated copper and low zinc. And these are the two minerals that affect the neurotransmitters for rage. If you have a minor irritation, which is felt by you as massive murderous rage, it's usually due to the excess copper and the lack of zinc. Because those are they affect the neurotransmitters that help you to sense the rage. And it's called PMS, and it's due to estrogen dominance. If you were to measure the copper or the zinc, you might not find that either one was out of range, but the balance is off. See, everything is involved with balance. Like if a room is cold or not, it depends on whether you're wearing enough sweaters or not. Or if you fly off a curve going around, it's a balance between the traction of the tires and the centrifugal force of the curve that's going to throw you off. Everything is in balance. That's the whole business of Oriental philosophy, the Tao, you know, the yin and yang, all of this stuff. And it's the only way to think. Nothing operates in a vacuum. Everything affects everything else. And so this is why these imbalances are very, very important. Now, just to give you an idea of where estrogen dominance comes from, I put that together. It comes from our diet. If you eat a lot more sugars and refined starches, your body will make a lot more cholesterol, and a lot of that will be transformed into estrogen. You can raise anybody's estrogen by just giving them a lot of donuts and pie crusts and things like that. And that's it. You know, at the turn of the century, our sugar sales in this country were about 1 to 2 pounds per person per year. You know what they are now? Up around 105 pounds per person per year. And teenagers, it's up over 300 pounds per person per year, almost a pound a day. And then people are wondering, why are kids having their periods earlier now? When my mother went through puberty at the turn of the century, the typical time was age 16. And now it's down around age 11 or 12. Whoa, that's one of the reasons. Not only is it the sugar, but it turns into more estrogen. So they're estrogen dominant very early. Phytoestrogen deficiency. Phytoestrogens are very weak-acting estrogens, which are not steroids, are found in plants, but they will occupy estrogen receptors, and therefore they tune down your own natural estrogen effect. Follow that? So fewer of the receptors are combining with the real estrogen, more of them combining with the phytoestrogen. So on people with high estrogen production, it'll protect you from. And where do you get the phytoestrogens? Well, you get them from beans, and you get them from herbs. What we call herbs, other people, other parts of the world call them food. They eat these things. They're in the dishes that they make. And you can get them from beans. And you can get them from soybeans, particularly. There's a good one in soy called Genistin. And you can do that, and that'll protect you. But then any excess calorie intake will do it. We eat far too many calories. This is what the Dr. Ellison for the World Health Organization, he says it doesn't matter what the people eat. The people eat so much more in relation to their work activity in the United States and North America and in Western Europe, they're going to get more estrogen, and they get more estrogen, then they're going to get these cancers. He believes it's excessive calorie intake for the energy expenditure we do. In other countries, for instance, I have patients who've gone to live in Denmark or Holland or France or something, and they have no problem with weight. They eat whatever they want. They come back home, they get heavy, and they can't understand it. They have to exercise like mad. And when in France, they lived on the third floor walk-up apartment, and they had a tiny little refrigerator that didn't hold very much. They had to walk to the market every day with their own string bag, and they had to get their veggies fresh and go in and eat them that day because there's no way to store them. And so they got more exercise, and they ate all the right stuff, and they couldn't help it. They were healthy. They come back to the United States, they drive to the market, get a week's supply of processed food that they can put in the freezer, and it's all bad for them, and they don't do any exercise in the process. And so they get all this extra estrogen, and they die. Impaired liver function. Too much wine drinking, cocktails, martinis, and everything damages your liver. And if you can't excrete the estrogen, where does it go? It stays in your body. So the estrogen you make becomes too much because your liver isn't doing very well. Or maybe you had hepatitis, or maybe you had mononucleosis, or maybe you had iron damage to your liver, and you need some extra nutritional help to get your liver to work. And environmental, the estrogens are fed to steers. You see, they take these poor animals and castrate them, remove the source of testosterone, because testosterone and estrogen, oppose each other in their action. They are antagonists. So they want to give the steers estrogen, because with estrogen, they know the steers are going to get to market weight with less food and less time, because estrogen causes you to get fat. So they like that to happen to the steers. They know that people who like to buy the meat from the steers like fat meat. So not only do they get them to the market in less food and less time, they get it with more fat in their meat, and they give them the estrogen to make that happen, and to make the estrogen work, they have to remove the testicles. So that's why we call them steers. Everybody know that? Everybody in Sonoma County who raises steers for food knows how to do this. Why doesn't your doctor know that giving you estrogen makes you fat? Somebody should tell Hillary. Xenoestrogen exposure during the embryo phase of life. This gets into the main thesis of what I'm talking about. I said this was a 20th century illness. This has not happened before. Women are becoming estrogen dominant where before they never were. Something is happening to your progesterone. You are not making the progesterone you ought to. And this is why you're estrogen dominant. Not only are you making more estrogen, you're making less progesterone. The progesterone is made by the follicles. What made the follicles? Does anybody know where the follicles? How do the follicles get in the ovary? Remember, you all start as one egg from your mama and one sperm from your daddy. They each have half of the chromosomes. When they combine, is the first complete cell. And then those cells start multiplying. And before you are 2 or 3 days old, they begin differentiating into the type of things they're going to become as they're grown up. In other words, the head, the spinal cord, the limb buds, they're all from beginning to differentiate. And by day 18 to day 23 of this early life, this embryo life, the male baby's testicles are being formed along with the Sertoli cell that is going to be making the sperm later on. The girl babies in those same days, the ovaries are developing little follicles, and inside the center of every follicle is an egg with one half of the chromosomes. They're all put in there before you are 3 months old. Isn't that amazing? When you are born, you have over 1 million follicles. By the time you go through puberty, you've got about 500,000 follicles still good. And that, you use up 120 follicles a month to get one good egg every month, you should have enough to last for a long time. But you're running out in about age 28, about age 30, about 32, you're running out of good follicles. What happened? What happened was back on day 18, your mom didn't even know she was pregnant. Somebody offered her a hamburger with a lot of DDT in it. It didn't hurt her, but it hurt the baby she's carrying, you. So your follicles, instead of carrying a good egg or being able to make progesterone, malfunction because of the damage done when you were 18 days old as an embryo. Whoa, isn't that something to think about? Now you see, why didn't people discover this? Well, do you know how our government agencies look for toxic material? They take animals that are healthy and they give them a bunch of it to see how much it takes to make them sick. Okay? So on the case of DDT and these insecticides and things like that, you have to give a lot to make the adult animal sick. Nowhere does anybody say that we're getting that much. Then the next step they do is to take an animal who's pregnant and give them some of the bad stuff and see how much it takes to see observable congenital abnormalities when the babies are born. The babies with the damaged follicles look fine. There's no obvious congenital deformity. You don't know she's been damaged until she's 35 years old, and she's already had 5 years of estrogen dominance and progesterone deficiency. Something is happening to her ovaries. But what happened was 32 years before. So we're a whole generation behind in observing the effect. We do not know what the effect of all of the toxic petrochemical products is on the babies who are born today and look fine. We will not know until they're 30 years old. You see what we're talking about? However, if you go back and observe the decline in sperm count in men, men over 40, sperm count decline has been 50% in the last 35 years. Whoa. Everybody agrees to this. Center for Disease Control, the FDA, EPA, National Institutes of Health, everybody agrees. This is what happened. If you draw that line and continue it on as if we didn't know and it didn't do anything, it crosses zero 2 generations from now. So there's a book written about this. It's entitled Our Stolen Future. We don't have a future. We got 2 generations to do something about this. If you draw a line on the incidence of progesterone deficiency, that crosses zero in about 2 generations. No woman will be able to have a baby. It could be that the last children to have a baby in this country have already been born. Whoa. So read the book, Our Stolen Future. It's by Theo. What's that? What if you're a vegetarian? You don't get nearly as much, even though they spray the vegetables. The vegetables, these the poisons are all fat soluble. And the animals are 25% fat, whereas grains and seeds and plants and everything are 1 or 2% fat, so they just can't contain as much. So Theo Coburn is the name of the author of the book. Okay, I have about 3 more slides I want to show. This one shows you what women die of and men. Number 1 is cardiovascular disease, and it's both men and women. And number 2 is cancer, and then come strokes. And there the women have more deaths of strokes because they're the ones the doctors are giving estrogen to. In the cancer, the men are a little bit ahead because they're the ones who've been smoking the longest. But in heart attacks, they're about the same. Now, there's something about that I want you to ponder. You all know that it's young men who die of heart attacks. My dad died at 49, his brother at 48 and 46. And my only male cousin had his first heart attack at 38, and I'm 68. So either I'm doing something right or I was adopted. And given the hereditary implications, I wish it were adopted. But the point is, maybe I did something right to protect it. But men, you all know, die of heart attacks. You read about it. Ex-football players, 52 years old, die of a heart attack. Healthiest guys in the world. But they've been building up a cholesterol plaque in their coronary arteries. And when it reaches 95-96% closure, it doesn't take much effort for the heart to suffer from not enough blood coming to it. So we all know what kills men. It's the cholesterol buildup in their blood, in their coronary arteries. But in women, they don't die at those ages of heart attacks. It never happens. It's very difficult to kill a lady with a heart attack prior to menopause. Can't be done. You have to wait about 10, 15 years after menopause, when you're 65, 70, 75 years old. Then you start dying like flies from heart attacks. And if you look at the woman's heart who dies, you do an autopsy on it, you don't find a cholesterol plaque there. You don't die from a cholesterol obstruction. Is that amazing? All this is well known. And they're still trying to stop you from eating cholesterol foods. It's crazy. It's not the cholesterol that kills women. So something else is doing it. Your arteries can go into spasm. Say you get a letter from the Internal Revenue Service. You're walking around all day long with their arteries in spasm. Say that somebody, you go out of here and find that somebody dented your car. Say that somebody says something bad about your daughter or your best friend. That's the type of people we are. And that's what monkeys are, too. Their arteries go into spasm. And in London, Dr. Peter Collins has been doing a similar test on real women, postmenopausal women. He's asking them to go on a treadmill electrocardiogram to see how much they can exercise before the cardiogram shows that the coronary arteries are a little insufficient, shows signs of ischemia. And then he sends them to their doctor to be put on conventional HRT, the estrogen with the Provera. Then they come back and they start doing the exercise, and right away they can see that the electrocardiogram puts them at risk. So they have to stop. So then he sends them to the doctor and says, now use HRT with real progesterone. So they do that. They come back. Not only are they as good as they were before they started the HRT, they're better. They can walk all day on the treadmill, and they don't get any spasm whatsoever. Progesterone protects from spasm of the coronary arteries. Simple as that. So if you want to die at 72, you go on conventional HRT, and it's going to get you. But if you want to stay healthy and watch your grandchildren grow up, go on real progesterone. They have better bones, better libido, won't get fat, and won't die young. Now, the second cause of death is cancer. There are two major factors in cancer. One is that the cells that are cancer cells multiply more rapidly than the cells from which they came, the normal cells. Say you have breast cancer. Those cells started as normal breast cells, and then they became a cancer cell, and they're multiplying more rapidly. So more of them are occurring, and that's why you get the tumors. But on the other hand, what's forgotten is apoptosis. Apoptosis is that our cells are designed to last for a certain length of time and then die on time. It's programmed cell suicide. All of health depends on the cells dying on time so that new cells coming along can take their place. That's how you stay healthy. Apoptosis. Before you are born, when the first limb buds appear in the embryo, the limb bud for the hand is like the flipper on a seal. There's no separation of the fingers. And then 3 or 4 months into the life in the as embryo, the cells that are between the fingers die off, and one by one the fingers separate out by apoptosis of the intervening web. Isn't that beautiful? All the development of your body requires apoptosis. All the health of your body through your whole life requires apoptosis, the programmed death of older cells, so new cells can replace it. So, the conventional way of treating cancer is to attack cell proliferation. They give poisons to your body that attack proliferating cells. Therefore, your hair falls out, your white blood cells can't multiply, you're at risk of dying from complications of the treatment, and they haven't changed the death rate on any cancer except for childhood leukemias and lymphomas. They are failures. They have to give you enough of the poison to kill you to kill the cancer. And because they don't want to do that, they can't kill the cancer. They've forgotten apoptosis. What if you could find something that resumed normal apoptosis? Well, now you have to find how do the cells do that. It turns out there's a gene in the chromosomes of every cell in your body telling it whether or not to go ahead with apoptosis or not. It's a balance, again, of two genes. One is BCL2, which tells the cell, don't commit apoptosis, keep multiplying. You can call that a cancer gene. In fact, it is called a cancer gene. It's called oncogene. That's the medical term for a cancer gene. The cells keep multiplying, become more of themselves, spread through your body, they do not die, and they are going to kill you. They are told to do that by gene BCL2. What controls gene BCL2? Another gene, P53. Gene P53 stops BCL2 and says to the cell, don't multiply so fast, and by the way, be sure to commit apoptosis on time. Though, scientists now have taken cell cultures and tried to figure out what controls the gene. What message to the cell tells which gene to turn on? And guess what? Estrogen turns on BCL2, the cancer gene, and progesterone turns on P53. So here you have the new syllogism for the treatment of cancer in the next century. This is the treatment. Gene BCL2 increases cell proliferation and delays apoptosis. P53 does the opposite. Estrogen upregulates gene BCL2, progesterone downregulates that gene and turns on P53. Therefore, it follows estrogen causes the cancer, progesterone protects you from the cancer. So if you don't want the cancers, you maintain your progesterone level. That's all there is to it. If you have the cancer, you restore the progesterone level. Recently, people say, John, there's nothing in the literature that I read that says anything about this. So I spent about 5 minutes at a computer at our local hospital. And here are 12 studies, all of them about these two genes and the relationship to the cancer, to progesterone and estrogen. And look, they're published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology, the American Cancer Society, the American Journal of Pathology, the International Journal of Cancer, International Journal of Cancer, American Journal of Epidemiology. You can look down on all of these. These are all world-class scientific journals. So when my colleagues say, John, we don't see this in the journals we read, I say, maybe you're reading the wrong journals. Anybody can go look this up, and they've been finding this now for the last 2 or 3, 4 years. Nobody's been doing anything about it. But here's a study, started in 1975. It became obvious that breast cancer was less likely to occur if they did the surgery in the second half of the menstrual month when progesterone was on board. If they did it in the first half of the month when progesterone hadn't started yet, you were more likely to have the cancer come back. So this doctor asked all the doctors in London at the surgical hospitals, starting in 1975, to record the amount of progesterone in the woman's blood on the day of surgery. Also estrogen, cortisol, and testosterone, but it was the progesterone that was the key. These are women with node-positive disease. These are the worst ones, the most difficult to survive. These are women with breast cancer that had already spread. And look what happened to the women who had barely adequate good progesterone. 4 nanograms per milliliter is at the lower end of the normal scale. The scale goes from 4 to 28. So doctor that did this, Dr. Moore, he said, well, let's take 4 and above as being normal. And they had a survival rate 18 years later of about 65 or 70%. Imagine, these are the most difficult, the ones most likely to die. Those that had a lower progesterone level had a survival rate of about 35%. Having the right progesterone on the day of surgery doubled the survival rate 18 years later. There is no treatment that exists that will double your survival time. Why isn't this measured? Now, remember at the beginning I said I treated my patients for osteoporosis who couldn't take estrogen because they already had a history of breast cancer? Well, I've followed these people now for 20 years. I had no idea whether they were going to die of their breast cancer or not. To this date, not one of them has, as far as I know. Now I've got one last one, if I may. Having written my books, I've become in the loop of communication with a lot of scientists around the world. This is from Dr. Ercole Cavalieri of the Epley Cancer Institute of the University of Nebraska. This is the culmination of 22 years of study to test to see not whether estrogen causes your cancers, but the mechanism. How does it do it? Learning the mechanism is what's convincing to most people. So this is the mechanism how estrogen causes cancer. There are 3 estrogens you make: estradiol, estrone, estriol. Estriol does not cause cancer in any way, shape, or form. It's estrone or estradiol. The one is Premarin and the other is estrace, the ones the doctors give. Now, when it passes through the liver, it gets an extra hydroxyl group, and they call that a catechol estrogen. That's in the process of being changed to be soluble in bile. And then it gets methylated, and from there on, it's perfectly safe. It has a methyl group attached, and there, from then on, it's perfectly safe. However, if it's in a woman who has been eating margarine and trans fatty acids instead of real essential fatty acids found in plants and vegetables and nuts and seeds and things like that, but eating garbage fatty acids like found in all of those nice clear oils that they sell for salad dressing at the Safeway store. Those are not the real oils that are in the plants. It might say safflower oil or corn oil or something, but it says from safflower, from corn oil. It's no longer the fat that is in those things. It's been transformed by the processing of the oil. That's why it's called trans fatty acids. They cannot be sold in Canada unless it says on the bottle how much of it is trans fatty acid instead of real fatty acids. So the part that is high trans fatty acid doesn't sell in Canada because people know. So where do they sell it? They sell it in a stupid third world country that has rules that they don't have to show how much is in their, the bottles. That country is the United States. So you all buy the bad stuff. And if you do, then you cannot perform this methylation. Then it becomes a quinone. There's a high nitrogen compound attaches to the place where the methyl group would, and then if you're not eating the amino acids that contain the sulfur in them, like cysteine and methionine, like is found in garlic and all beans, if you manage to live your life without eating good beans, then you pass another checkpoint that Mother Nature would have put in, and now it'll go through the DNA and it'll bind the DNA, cause a mutation, and it leads directly to cancer. It is not that it promotes cancer. It's not that it increases the rate at which cancer grows. Estrogen that the doctor is giving causes the cancers. Does it? Do you begin to get a little idea about what this battle is about? I only give talks at companies that make a cream with the right amount of progesterone in it. There are companies out there making money, again, selling creams that have little or no progesterone in them, or way too much. But the ones that where it's easy to get a normal physiological level, that's the ones I'm happy to go and tell people about, and because I think it's important to not only your health, but to my grandchildren's health later on. There are changes that we have to make in the world, so you have to understand what the problem is, and then you find a solution. That's why I trust the women's intelligence to do that. Thank you.
You've been listening to Graveyards Are Full of Women That Shouldn't Be There, a talk by John Lee, M.D. For more information on Dr. Lee's work, you can visit his website at www.johnleemd.com. That's johnleemd.com. Additional information on natural hormones for women and men is available at www.hormoneprofile.com. That's hormoneprofile.com. Links to these sites will also be available on the Unwelcome Guests website at www.unwelcomeguests.org. Check the show archive listing for show number 153.
I'm not feeling quite as good as I feel I should. All wrapped up in things of the past. And I'm too scared to let it show. I'm too scared in case you don't know. It's just a passing phase. So I say I'm okay. Thanks for asking, I'm okay.
Contrary to popular belief, electroconvulsive therapy or electroshock is not on the decline. In fact, its use is actually increasing, especially on women. Our next speaker is Dr. Bonnie Burstow, a psychotherapist and senior lecturer at the University of Toronto and the former co-chair of the Ontario Coalition Against Electroshock. She spoke last March in Toronto.
So my topic today is as clear as electroshock. And whenever I tell people that I'm talking about electroshock, whether I told people this in the 70s or in the 80s or in the 90s or today, I've almost always gotten from some people the exact same response. How come wasn't that discontinued years ago? Well, electroshock was not discontinued years ago. And no, it didn't almost disappear. There's approximately the same amount of shock given today that there was in 84 when the Ontario Coalition to Stop Electroshock was in its heyday. And there promises to be more because there is a huge push right now by shock doctors. But what you can hear is that shock doctors are lamenting the tragedy of insufficient shock being used. And so it's a very important thing for us to be on top of. So let me start by saying a little bit about shock. It's a fascist invention, and when I say that, I'm not talking metaphorically. Shock began in fascist Italy. It was invented in 1938 by a man called Cerletti. And Cerletti visited a slaughterhouse and saw pigs being pacified by the application of electrical prods to their heads. And he decided to try it on a human being. A patient, a homeless man, actually, was brought to the hospital against his will. And against his will, he was then used as a guinea pig. Cerletti, in the meantime, had invented a crude shock machine. And this man who had never came there and didn't want to be there was strapped down and electrodes were attached to his head and he was given electroshock. After the first few shocks, he screamed, "Not another one, it's deadly." That was the beginning of this highly touted treatment. By 1940, it had already been introduced into the States, and by the early 40s, it had become a standard part of the psychiatric regimen. Shock today is not that much different than shock was in the 40s and 50s. The only major advance is the giving of muscle relaxants so the back wouldn't break. In the 80s, I was part of an organization that held 3 days of public hearings in which people who got shock came to testify. And the recurrent themes identified by the shock survivors were damage, terror, lack of safety, horrific memory loss. Many testified that they would prefer death to ever being subjected to this procedure again. All but two people who testified called for the complete abolition of electroshock. But I want to begin by introducing you to a definition, and I'm quoting here from a neurologist, a man called Sidney Samant. Samant says, and I quote, "As a neurologist and an electroencephalographer, I have seen many patients after ECT. ECT produces effects identical to those of head injury. Electroconvulsive therapy, in effect, may be defined as a controlled form of brain damage produced by electrical means. In electroshock, a person is given an anesthetic and a muscle relaxant, also oxygen because they stop breathing. Then the person's head is attached to a shock machine by virtue of two electrodes. The machine is turned on, and then 100 and 100 to 150 volts of electricity is passed through the brain. Generally, a course is 6 to 8 treatments. The amount must be sufficient to create a grand mal seizure, a convulsion, hence the name electroconvulsive therapy. Significantly, in real medicine, doctors try to stop others from having grand mal seizures, as they know this means brain damage, not with shock doctors. They try to produce it, and they do produce it. It creates lesions in the brain. The brain bleeds, cells disappear, ghost cells appear. Nowadays, psychiatrists are into denying that shock causes brain damage because they are confronted with a populist who, for some reason, is not so keen on brain damage. But they didn't bother denying it in the early days because there weren't any objections. And so it's very important to go to these early people because they actually were honest about what it did. The early shock doctors made it very clear that it is precisely the brain damage or intellectual impairment that makes this treatment, quote, therapeutic, unquote. Let me quote here from the second biggest name in the saga of electroshock, psychiatrist and electroshock mentor Dr. Abraham Meyerson. Meyerson said, and I quote, "These people have more intelligence than they can handle, and the reduction of intelligence is an important factor in the curative process," unquote. Along with brain damage comes enormous memory loss. It's not surprising there's memory loss. You put holes in people's head, it stands to reason that there's going to be memory loss. You rampantly destroy brain cells, and of course you're going to wipe out memory attached to those cells. Now, we know about memory loss from studies. There's umpteen studies that prove it. We know it from patient reports. Studies show that up to 90% of patients on ECT complain of ongoing memory loss. Of course, there are doctors who discount this evidence, in fact, many, many doctors, saying that the patients are imagining it and that these complaints are simply proof of ongoing neurosis. Significantly, an ECT review committee set up by the government in Ontario in the 80s to look into the shock clearly concluded memory loss. Let me quote here. "ECT causes memory loss varying from minor and transient to severe and long-term." Actually, there's two kinds of memory loss created. There's retrograde amnesia, and that's loss of memory of things that happened prior to shock, and antegrade amnesia, that's inability to remember stuff that happens after shock. The ability to remember new things is impeded. I can't overstate what a serious impediment to a decent life this destruction of memory is, this menticide is. We need memory to navigate the world. You cannot even go into a grocery store and shop if you cannot rely on memory. As human beings, we can't make decisions without memory. When we make decisions, we not only project ourselves toward the future, we project ourselves back into the past so we can make effective selections of behavior that has served us in the past. We can't do that if we can't remember what we did in the past. We don't know what we like, what we are attached to, who we are. Memory is the foundation of our identity, and you interfere with memory and you profoundly interfere with the integral whole that is the human being. And significantly, that interference can be very, very major indeed. I want to say, as a therapist specializing in this, is I've seen people with 5 to 20 years wiped out. Some shock survivors have had all of their memory before shock wiped out. Illustrative of this in this regard is Linda McDonald. At 23, she was a young married woman with children. She was depressed from the duties that fall to young mothers. She was given electroshock, and she never again remembered any of her children, her husband, anyone. Even when memory loss is not that extensive, it still has profoundly interferes with people. I'd like to briefly quote from testimony with a shock survivor and a fellow activist Shirley Johnson gave to a meeting of the Toronto Board of Health. She said, and I quote, "The memory loss is especially painful, since I could not remember a lot of times when the children were growing up, the two younger girls more so, since the shocks were closer to their birth. The two older children, I do not remember their graduation. Many times my family and friends would bring up happenings that I had to question them about to test whether the memory would return. I feel so alien because of this damage. I used to cover up a lot of times, thinking if I listened more and rested a lot before going out, it would be easier. Finally, when the anxiety got so bad, I would completely avoid people, and especially social gatherings where I was supposed to know people and remember their names," unquote. I want you to imagine the devastation for women whose primary identities are mothers that cannot remember their various things that happened to their children. I also want to add, while we're on Shirley, that one of the last times Shirley was electroshocked in another ward in the same hospital, her son was being electroshocked. And her son was a musician, and it deprived him of his ability to remember music because you don't know what's going to go. And he killed himself. And so look at the devastation of shock on this family. Is there a way of predicting how much memory or what memory will go? No. A person could have 8 shock and have minimal damage. A person could have 1 shock and have horrendous damage. The point is, shooting electricity through someone's brain is a bit like letting a bull loose in a china shop. You know there's going to be havoc wreaked. You just don't know where and how much. Doctors themselves, I'd like to add, are really aware on some level that it creates memory loss. They have to be with all the proof. Indeed, in many cases, they are not only aware of the memory loss, despite denying or trivializing it, they are counting on memory loss. Shock is frequently used precisely to erase memory that is causing the person problems, and even more, that's causing other people problems. And indeed, often the person feels a bit better, not always, but sometimes they do, because they no longer remember what's bothering them. The problem is, no one tells them what the treatment does and that they're going to be brain damaged for life. The problem is, people cannot solve problems when they can't remember them. We need our memory to work through issues. One of the tragedies of this so-called process is that people are left with no way of addressing what is bothering them because they cannot remember what is bothering them. And so they continue to be plagued. Imagine in this regard a childhood sexual abuse survivor whose memories are just beginning to surface, who gets depressed and confused and who is electroshocked, and you'll get some sense of how counterproductive this treatment is. I'd like to add that I've worked with a number of shock survivors who appear to have had something very traumatic happen in their childhood, but we can't get at it. Not because they've repressed it, but because the shock has made it inaccessible. Routinely, shock is used precisely to wipe out memory that causes the person trouble, and the person ends up severely impaired in their ability to navigate the world. This is routine and intentional use of shock to damage the brain. And what goes along with this, shock is sometimes given as a punishment or a threat both to women and men. In this regard, I'd like to remind people of the case of Cheryl Brown. Cheryl was sexually abused by her psychiatrist, Dr. Henry Fenigstein. Fenigstein threatened her with shock if she ever revealed it. Well, in this case, it was the psychiatrist whose interest was served, as it often is. It may be someone other than the psychiatrist whose interest the erasure of memory serves. Though I don't want to unduly emphasize this, I have certainly known many people who were shocked once they started suggesting the possibility of sexual abuse. And so one scenario that we sometimes see is the father sexually abuses the daughter as the daughter grows up. She starts making accusations while acting in ways that others recognize or think of as strange, and the father signs for electroshock. There are also other common effects of shock, and it's a huge and frightening list, but I want to name a few. Confusion, physical weakness, cardiovascular complications, lower IQ, delirium, brainwave abnormalities, epilepsy, learning disabilities, and death. From what I've been saying to date, I'm sure that that you're getting a sense of why I'm saying this procedure is bad, like real bad. It's fraudulent, it's unacceptably injurious, and it's dehumanizing. It is essentially nothing but a medically induced closed head injury masquerading as treatment, and it seriously detracts from people's ability to lead a full life. You're also probably beginning to see why I am calling it a feminist issue. It controls women, it punishes women, it threatens women, it protects abusive men. But you may be wondering why I keep saying women and why I am emphasizing that it is a feminist issue. So let me proceed now to who gets shock. In short, disproportionately, women get this abysmal treatment. Throughout the history of electroshock, women have received shock to 2 to 3 times as often as men. It is true in every country in the world in which shock is given, which is the vast majority of countries, but let's stick for a second to Ontario. This is the last stats that I have on overheads. So number of ECTs given provincially, 15,593. Number of patients, 2,554. The percentage of patients given ECT in provincial institutions that are women, 71%. Percentage of ECT given in provincial institutions given to women, 75%. In other words, 75% of the shock given in provincial institutions in Ontario is given to women. So you can see that's 3 times the amount given to men. So there's a huge discrepancy between women and men. Now, it's also given to vulnerable men, and I don't want to forget men here, especially men less valued in the patriarchy. In this regard, I'd like to point out something, and gay men living with AIDS are in particular jeopardy of ECT. Something horrible isn't happening here, but in all fairness, we need to ask if there's anything about psychiatry's claims to effectiveness. What's electroshock supposed to do? Relieve depression. What do effectiveness studies say? Brill did a controlled experiment with unmodified, modified, and simulated shock and showed that all three were just as effective. Simulated shock is where you don't do anything and they think they've had shock. Longitudinal studies by people like Johnson show that any greater effectiveness over a placebo disappears within 4 weeks. So, in other words, these guys are zapping women's brains, damaging women's brains for 1 month of feeling high sometimes, and generally for nothing. There's one other claim to effectiveness that psychiatry keeps putting forward. The claim is it is effective in preventing suicide. What do the studies show? Control studies with some trouble, people getting shock and some not, and there was no difference in suicide rate among those who were shocked and those who weren't shocked. In other words, it has no effectiveness in preventing suicide. So what do we have here? We have an ineffective, brain-damaging treatment that destroys people's lives, and it is overwhelmingly given to women. Why is it given overwhelmingly to women? Well, let me back up here before I answer that and say, why is it given at all? I think there's a lot of answers to this. I don't want to just try one. I think one of the reasons psychiatrists give it is they don't know what to do. They're not good therapists. Their drugs are useless. And so they, you know, once all that happens, if the person doesn't start feeling well by themselves just from being away from their family, it comes to mind to electroshock them. It also feels right to some doctors. There's a long history of within psychiatry of treatments that border on torture. There's a long history of treatments purposely meant to scare people. Electroshock fits very well into those. It's quick. It's a cheap way to address people's suffering in a dehumanizing society without actually having to address the causes of suffering, and so the government wouldn't mind supporting that. I want to be clear, though, that shock is an industry. It's not just a treatment. And it's an industry with vested interests involved. There is a huge literature out there that normalizes and regulates shock. Shock doctors are raised in the philosophy of shock. Shock doctors are major shareholders in companies that sell shock machines. So this is a partial explanation, but it's still only a partial answer. So let me go back to the question. What do shock doctors say about the discrepancy? Why more women, 2 to 3 times as many women as men are shocked? They rationalize it by reminding us it is intended for depression and that women are depressed 2 to 3 times as often as men. Let me acknowledge there's some validity in what they're saying here. Women are depressed more than men. We're depressed because we live in a sexist society. We're depressed because of battery. We're depressed because of relegation of women to second-class citizens. We're depressed because of social conditions. And it is these conditions that need to be changed, not our brains. In addition to that, as I've already indicated, it makes no sense shocking women for depression, for studies have proven that shock has no efficacy with depression. Well, despite the muddy thinking going on here, it does look like women's understandable emotional problems under the patriarchy is being pathologized, and that is a key reason why women are disproportionately shocked. Another salient answer, though it's not always the case, is that significant men in their lives have been known to push for, sometimes male partners. A more fundamental answer to why women in particular get electroshock is that psychiatry is a patriarchal institution, and what goes along with this, approximately 90% of shock doctors are men. And significant in this regard is how the patriarchy still regards women. Men do not understand women and easily see women as defective, especially women experiencing emotional difficulty. Also, they're more likely to see women as needing extreme measures, which translates into imposed control. Women are seen as invalid, as not in control of our emotions, as needing to be kept within strict limits. Men's inability to understand women and discomfort with feeling, in other words, is a contributive factor. Obviously, another answer, as I was suggesting earlier, is shock wipes out memory, and women have memory that is sometimes very inconvenient for the patriarchy. I'd also like to point out that many of the early promoters of ECT explicitly recommended shock for women and for, quote, men whose jobs did not require a lot of thinking, unquote. If we ask, who are those men whose jobs do not require a lot of thinking, it isn't a large step to realize that these early advocates of shock, at very least, had in mind working class men and men of color. Put this together, and what we have is the covering up of abuse, callousness toward women, profound disrespect for women, reduction of women to nothing but a pile of emotions which are, with a brain attached to them, which for the most part is in the way and you might want to reduce. We also see the standard infantilizing of women with all the players cast in the old roles. Men, and let me be clear on this, disproportionately white men, cast as competent parental father figure, women as child, cast as child. More generally, we see an attempt to control women, whether through memory loss, threat, punishment, terrorizing, or brainwashing. We see it generally, and we also see it in concrete cases. Ewan Cameron was particularly into control. Ewan Cameron was the psychiatrist at the infamous Allan Memorial Institute in Montreal, and he was responsible for rapid electroshock and psychic driving, a combination of two things, depatterning and psychic driving. Okay, depatterning was mainly the electroshock, so he gave people a number of electroshocks a day. The idea was that you wipe the mind clean. Now, these are his words, not mine. He wrote them up in journals, nice, respected psychiatric journals. You wipe the mind clean in order to create, quote, a tabula rasa, unquote. That is, a blank sheet on which to write. Once you did that, you can then do the psychic driving and implant the messages people should have. So women and men both were subjected to this combination of shock and implanted messages coming from the tapes underneath their pillows as they were forced to sleep all the time. Common messages for women were, you are a bad mother, you are a bad wife. Shock doctors are still trying to wipe out women's memories. And additionally, they're still trying to force women to be good mothers and wives. My example is a woman shocked in 1990 whose name is Wendy Funk. Wendy was bullied into accepting shock in the 90s, and what was wrong with her? She was tired and she had a sore throat and went to the doctor. And the doctor kept saying things like, you know, you really shouldn't work outside of the house. This is not fair to your husband and children. And she started crying, and then he said, well, you're obviously very upset. We need to put you in an institution. So she ended up in a psychiatric institution. And within a short time of being here, she was told she'd be relegated to the back wards if she didn't have shock, that she would consent to shock if she cared at all about her family, And she needed shock because she was not acting like a proper wife and was, and here's the word, quote, consumed with feminist-type thinking, unquote. It's not just wives and mothers, of course, that shock doctors try to control. I remind people here of the case of Sheila Gahuli. Sheila was a lesbian, and women are not supposed to be lesbians, for the patriarchy is nothing if not heterosexist. Sheila was given electroshock in the 1980s in BC for the unspeakable crime of being a lesbian. Significantly, after each shock, she was asked, "Do you still not want to be cured of being a lesbian?" Put together the issue of control with profound damage, which we know shock does, and what we are seeing here is state-supported form of violence against women. Electroshock is electrical assault on the brains of women. It is battery to women's brains, and as in traditional battery, women are being told it is for their own good. In this battery, in this case, it's called treatment, and it is legitimated and paid for by the state. The signs of the battery are the signs we always find in violence against women. Actual physical damage from men attacking women's bodies, male threats, also one further dimension by which we have come to recognize full-blown violence against women, and that's the psychological aftermath. Let me quote some of the testimony from hearings held into shock. Quote, "I never felt so helpless and vulnerable in all my life," unquote. Quote, "I was helpless in stopping this kind of treatment," unquote. Quote, "It's degrading, it's humiliating," unquote. I have combed through testimony by women shock survivors and can clearly identify the expectable and routine psychological effects of electroshock. They are sense of helplessness, low self-esteem, humiliation, terror, ongoing effort to please so as not to be punished further, also initial minimization, denial, attempt to hide the damage. Does it sound familiar? I have already named a number of standard features of trauma that pertain to shock. Sense of danger, terror, low self-esteem. Just in case there's any doubt, I'd also like to name other attributes of trauma that you clearly find with shock survivors. Being haunted by it, having nightmares about it, re-experiencing it so the person feels it's happening to them all over again, so that it's happening now. Also, as in all trauma, women are frequently triggered by stuff that ends up associated with the traumatic event. For a number of shock survivors I know, they're triggered by anything electrical, by electric cords, by electrical outlets. What we have here is recognizable if we dare to recognize it. My invitation today is that we dare to recognize it, that we throw away garbage terms like treatment and therapy, that we reconceptualize electroshock as a serious form of violence against women, as the traumatizing of women, and that we mobilize against that violence just as we've mobilized against wife battery and childhood sexual abuse. The anti-psychiatry movement has been mobilizing against shock for decades, and that mobilization has always included some awareness of feminist issues. We have demonstrated, we've made innumerable deputations, we've held public hearings, but that movement can only get so far. The strategic need at this juncture is an alliance between feminist organizations and anti-psychiatry organizations. In the meantime, I'd like to at least have us find ways to safeguard women in special jeopardy. And don't get me wrong, I also would like to safeguard men in special jeopardy. So which women are in particular jeopardy? Obviously, all severely depressed women. However, one form of depression really jumps out at you as you start reading women's testimony about their own victimization. Just after giving birth, women experience a completely natural event that we all know about, postpartum depression. It is not a disease. It'll go away by itself. And for this completely natural occurrence that does not need to be treated, they are subjected to brain-damaging treatment. What other women are in special jeopardy? Women with so-called eating disorders. Housewives, now there's a big category. Lesbians. Gay men living with AIDS. Let me go off women and just go on to people generally. It's not clear whether people of color are in more jeopardy, and we don't get it represented in the shock statistics, so they don't do the breakdown. We need the breakdown, given that the psychiatry is an institution which has a long, long history of racism. And I want to end with a discussion of the elderly. Just as shock is given disproportionately to women, shock is given disproportionately to the elderly. The disproportionate use of electroshock with the elderly is a comparatively new trend, but a very strong trend. One, of course, that fits right into the dominant approaches to the elderly, the warehousing, the drugging. What rationale do psychiatrists give for disproportionately shocking the elderly? That they have to use electroshock because the psychiatric drugs pose a problem for the elderly with heart problems. Let me be clear. I have absolutely no problem with psychiatrists not giving the elderly these horrible drugs. I have a major problem with them saying, let's shock them instead. The elderly may already be suffering from confusion from memory loss, and shock exacerbates this. Moreover, the more fragile the brain, the greater the risk that shock will result in extensive brain damage, and like every other part of our bodies, our brains are more fragile as we get older. On top of this, electroshock poses a danger to the heart. Given women are at special risk of electroshock, and the elderly are at risk, of course, it only stands to reason that older women are in enormous jeopardy. Women over 60 get 52% of the electroshock given in Ontario. Women over 60. Obviously, in this sexist age of society, elderly women's brains are especially expendable. We now, again, are getting an answer to who these people are who have more intelligence than they can handle. That, I would suggest, is part of the answer. Depression as a result of societal neglect, as a result of societal ageism, societal sexism, is another. As women get older and past childbearing years, women's situation frequently worsens. Women are no longer needed in many arenas as they are not producing children, not raising children, and are no longer of that same service to the patriarchy. Additionally, in many cases, women as they get older get very poor. They have more objective troubles. Given this, it is not surprising that many older women are depressed. What is sad is that older women are then punished for that depression by being subjected to further damage, and yet that is expectable because for psychiatry, depression is a license to shock, the person being a woman is a license to shock, and the person being old is a license to shock. What compounds this problem? There is often now no one there to protect elderly women from being shocked, no one there to stand up for elderly women, and so older women are being shocked again and again and again. As feminists, let me suggest we take the shocking of women seniors very seriously. And that said, I'd like to end by inviting people to identify. Many of us, women and men both, are already seeing the effects of age on our brains. We forget names. Some of us forget appointments. I know I won't name any names. Appointments, that's a nuisance for us now. I ask you to imagine how very much worse things could get if you had 150 volts of electricity surging through your brains. Women are the caregivers in society. Women serve society. After this service, is this what women have to look forward to? Is this the reward? Is this acceptable or palatable to us? Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. Bonnie Burstow, anti-electroshock activist and psychotherapist, speaking last March in Toronto. Thanks to CKLN in Toronto for that tape. On Friday, May 16th, the Hearts of Peace Experience, in conjunction with the Cayuga Coalition for Peace, will present A Peaceful Evening Without TV. The event will take place at the First Methodist Church at 90 South Street in Auburn from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. and will include live musicians and dancers, local artists, irrelevant, irreverent humor, poignant poetry, and sublime storytelling. That's Friday, May 16th. Proceeds will go to benefit the Simukai Program for the Booker T. Washington Community Center and Veterans for Peace. A donation of $3 is requested, but no one will be turned away for lack of funds. If you appreciate hearing this and other programs on 88.1 FM in Ithaca, please support Ithaca Community Radio. To find out how, visit www.ithacaradio.org. And be sure to tune in to the Ithaca Radio Hour, heard Monday evenings at 6:30 on WEOS Geneva and 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. You can contact us through our website at www.unwelcomeguests.org.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle.